I'll call to order the General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. Colleagues, today is Monday, February 14th, 2011. Happy Valentine's Day. And we are convened to introduce some committee measures and also have public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 11, Senate Bill 14, Senate Bill 16, Senate Bill 109, Senate Bill 110. And colleagues, we looks like we're going to need an amendment for Senate Bill 14, so we do not anticipate moving Senate Bill 14 today, but I think we have everything we need to send the rest of them, and we should be out of here relatively early and on time. Patrick, anything for the good of the order?
No, Mr. Chair, I think we can launch right in.
Okay. Then I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 11. Patrick?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 11 stipulates that the Deputy State Treasurer may, in the event of a vacancy in the Office of State Treasurer, exercise the duties of the State Treasurer. It specifies that the Deputy State Treasurer maintains those duties assigned by the former State Treasurer until they are modified by the subsequent State Treasurer. It also changes the title of Chief Deputy State Treasurer to Deputy State Treasurer. The measure has an emergency clause and will take effect upon signature by the Governor. There is no fiscal impact and no revenue impact to this measure, Mr. Chair.
All right. Michael, are you going to testify on behalf of the Treasurer's Department? Please come on up. Please identify yourself and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Salvaggio from the Oregon State Treasury. Senate Bill 11, as the committee minister described, is a fairly simple measure. I'm sure that we can remember about a year ago, State Treasurer Ben Westland passed away while in office and left a legal ambiguity in his wake. The State Treasury was without Treasurer for a period of about 3 or 4 days, depending on how you measure that. And in that time, there were many documents that needed to be signed. And although our Deputy Treasurer at the time, Mr. Darren Bond, had been given signatory authority by Treasurer Westland, the question remained, did that authority remain with Deputy Treasurer Bond or did it expire with the former treasurer? The Department of Justice was good enough to return a very quick advisory saying that it indeed did remain with the deputy, and we were able to sign our documents and conduct our business as usual. However, we would like that, and also the request of the Department of Justice, I believe, that we incorporate that into statute. So what we've done is we've created a bill here that, again, as was described, the Deputy Treasurer, in the event of a unanticipated vacancy, would assume not only would retain the abilities granted by the previous treasurer, also assume any statutory duties that may have fallen through the cracks and for whatever reason were not delegated. For the record, I believe our current Deputy Treasurer has the full menu of authorities. And then at the time the new treasurer was sworn in, he or she would have the ability to alter those duties as he or she saw fit. It also makes two technical adjustments to statute with regards to treasury personnel. Currently, everyone in the state treasury, aside from the treasurer, chief of staff, and the deputy, is either a clerk or a stenographer. That is obviously outdated language. We do more work than clerking or stenography. The other change is that it changes the title of the Deputy State Treasurer to Chief Deputy. I'm sorry, reverse that. It changes the title from Chief Deputy State Treasurer to Deputy State Treasurer because we have only one deputy.
Okay. Any questions for Michael? All right. Thank you very much. I will assume nobody else is here to testify on that bill. Okay. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 11 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 11. Senator George?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 11 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Could you please call the roll?
Senator
Bobanicki?
Aye.
Senator
Rosa? Aye.
Senator
Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Chair
Hsu? Aye. Okay. Motion passes. Carrier Senator Bonamici, will you carry this
yes,
controversial
thank
bill
you.
On the floor?
Thank you.
Senator Bonamici is the carrier, and I will close the work session on Senate Bill 11 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 14. Patrick.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 14, also from the State Treasurer's Office. This bill allows the State Treasurer to authorize exceptions to the requirements of the deposit of public funds to state agencies in order to conduct business through electronic commerce. This measure has an emergency clause and would take effect upon signature by the governor. There is a no revenue impact statement, and this bill has minimal fiscal impact according to the legislative fiscal office.
Okay. And could we please bring up Cora Parker and Michael Salvaggio again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Cora Parker. I'm the Director of Finance for the Oregon State Treasury. In that capacity, my staff and I are responsible for cash management functions for Oregon state agencies and where it's applicable for Oregon local governments. As you know, ORS Chapter 295 provides a number of important safeguards regarding the deposit and holding of Oregon public funds. While the provisions of the chapter are obviously very important to the ongoing protection of public funds, we have identified an exception for you that we think is worthy of your consideration today. Notably, Chapter 295 requires that public funds be held in an Oregon depository and that they be essentially segregated from other funds or held on behalf of the public entity that is depositing them. The statutory requirement has had the effect of limiting the ability of certain state agencies to engage in a certain type of e-commerce opportunity. As you're well aware, technology has changed fairly rapidly over the last several years, particularly over the last decade. More and more online services are available by vendors with nationwide or even worldwide exposure. This can be important to a limited number of Oregon programs. Companies include eBay, Amazon, and others, and again, their models allow for a marketing exposure that would otherwise not be available to the programs that we're talking about. And we'll talk about a couple of examples here in a minute. Unfortunately, those organizations that I just mentioned do not typically deposit with Oregon institutions and oftentimes don't have the ability to change their models, I should say the ability or the willingness, to change their depository models in order to comply with those provisions. And what that really has the effect of doing is essentially limiting Oregon's ability to participate with them. You might ask why that would be important to us right now, particularly where we're in a position of wanting to recommend and encourage the use of local institutions. And certainly this is intended to be an exception and would be nothing more than that. In fact, we agree that there would continue to be only very limited use of that exceptions, but for those programs where it is critical, it will continue to be critical to exposure of the goods and services that they may have for sale. So let's take one of those examples, and probably the one that is really most critical to us right now is state surplus. Selling surplus through eBay has been a really smart business decision for them. The nationwide exposure has significant positive impacts on the revenue for the program. However, because PayPal, the service that is typically used for those items that are sold on eBay, does not deposit funds into an Oregon depository, it's not in compliance with the provisions of ORS Chapter 295, and therefore is not permitted for use by state surplus. Because of that restriction, and when eBay was in its infancy, they were able to work directly with eBay, State Surplus was able to work with them, and create a model that was in compliance with ORS Chapter 295. It's a special model that allows them to currently deposit funds directly into a state institution. However, as eBay has increased its presence and revised its own operational processes, we now find that that exception is out of compliance with their model. eBay has granted state surplus a temporary exception until a viable solution can be found, but there is no specific time frame for that exception, and frankly, it could end at any given point in time. Unfortunately, if it were to end, that would create a number of financial and logistical problems for state surplus and for their customers. A similarly structured program, one that has a relationship very similar to state surplus with eBay, is the estate liquidation process through the Division of State Lands, and they're currently operating with a similar relationship with eBay, again, an exception process. So how would the provisions of Senate Bill 14 address that issue? The bill would provide for exceptions to the usual depository requirements, and it would give the State Treasurer's Office the ability to grant essentially exceptions to those provisions. It would allow us the ability to create policies and processes around granting those exceptions as well. I want you to know and understand that Treasury already has a number of safeguards in place and that we would continue to use those when evaluating the appropriateness of any of those exception requests. Our existing third-party vendor policy and review process helps us to evaluate proposed vendors and determine whether they are currently in compliance with the provisions of Chapter 295. In fact, it's often going through that review process that has pointed out in the past where potential vendors aren't in compliance with that model. In most cases, we're able to work with those vendors and determine a solution so that they can come into compliance. In fact, in all cases to date, we obviously work with them and figure out either a way for them to come into compliance with the provisions of 295, or they can't be used by the agency. Or in the rare exception for eBay, they were able, to create a process outside of eBay's processes for them. We would continue to use that third-party vendor agreement, and we would, in cases where we found that an exception or workable solution to come into compliance with 295 was not available, then we would require the state agency who is requesting the exception to submit to us a clear business case that identified the criticality of that exception, including a risk analysis and approaches to mitigating any additional risks that exposure may create. Assuming that the business case clearly substantiates that need to use the vendor, we would then work with them to go through the typical due diligence process. Again, we have access to ratings of banking institutions and organizations, and we would continue to evaluate them based on those ratings and other important due diligence factors. We'll continue to require that the vendor and their banking institution provide evidence of having met industry security standards, and they'll continue to have to annually certify to those compliance standards as well. We want to make it clear the exception provided for in this bill would be exactly that, an exception. We do not anticipate that the number of approved exception requests will be significant. In fact, the two that I identified for you today are probably two of maybe three or four that would even come forward initially. We do recognize, however, that the continued demand for online services will increase the probability that at least a few of Oregon's revenue-producing programs will encounter this kind of significant limitation. In summary, the bill would allow Treasury to improve vendor services that don't currently conform to Chapter 295 depository requirements, but only when it is in the best interest of the state and only with the continued safeguards otherwise applied to our oversight of public funds. The approval would be rare. Treasury would continue to work towards a goal of having public funds deposited directly into state accounts. Where a clear business case exists, however, the provisions of this bill would allow the state to take advantage of those e-commerce opportunities that would otherwise not be available. We recommend your support of the bill with the amendments proposed by DOJ, and I think that Mr. Savaggio is going to speak to those.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'll just be very, very brief and say that the amendments include some technical changes submitted by the Department of Justice and do not change the substance of the bill to my layperson eye, but this is what the Department of Justice has asked for.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking to see
The amendment. Chair Shields, members of the committee, the amendments have not been returned to us.
Okay, thank
at
you.
This point.
I do have a question, though. Thank
That's
you.
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask, Ms. Parker, you made several comments about how this is intended to be an exception, and I'm sure we all appreciate the policy reasons for the current requirement that requires requires the public funds to be held in an Oregon depository. And you talked about the safeguards and the exceptions several times, but when I read the bill, I don't see any of that in the bill. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because you really have to, I guess, there's a lot you said in your testimony that I'm not seeing in the bill. So if you could talk a little bit about how you're going to assure that the things that you said in your testimony and in writing are actually followed, because there isn't anything here that says that the procedure standards and related requirements need to incorporate what you assured us would happen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, in fact, the amendments that we've requested do clarify that language in greater detail, so that it makes it narrows, if that's an appropriate description, narrows the exception that the original bill otherwise appears was intended, so that it makes it very clear that it's only with respect to, I'm just looking here, only with respect to very specific e-commerce requirements, and that the procedure standards and requirements otherwise required under 293.875 come into play. So that amendment, when you see it, will in fact directly address that.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Chair, if I may ask a question again when I see the amendment. Thank you.
Senator George.
I discussed this earlier with your colleague, Ms. Parker, but I'm trying to understand exactly the reason why we put these things in state statute as far as using the state certified depository is because of the fact is we want to make sure those funds are protected.
Correct.
So when we do this, are we exposing the state's funds to an unprotected status, in essence, because those funds will, in essence, pass into a third party's hands that we don't have any regulatory control over? I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that, or if that's an accurate reflection of the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, the provisions of our current policies and processes are intended to address exactly those issues. Certainly, this is an exception. So certainly, there is the possibility that some of the vendors, if you will, that we'll be working with will have a slightly greater risk than those institutions that are otherwise covered by ORS 295. That's exactly why we'll require those agencies who are requesting those exceptions to identify for us the clear business case. And again, it's not we think we can get some marginal value on the dollar. It's got to be a clear business case. It's got to clearly address any additional risk items and clearly address how they will mitigate any of those additional risks. So those could be dollar limits. Those could be timing limits. There's any number of additional limits that could be identified with respect to each particular scenario that we're looking at. And again, with respect to what depository institutions these vendors may otherwise be using, we have the ability and would continue to use that review process to make sure that that we are protecting those public funds to the greatest extent we can, even though they may fall outside of what our normal process is.
Follow up. If you could, for us, when you guys come back, is maybe give us a list of agencies that have been interested in this and the kind of dollar figures they're talking about. I mean, what we don't want to do is get into a situation, if we could, is where somebody's giving the state a great deal because they're making their money on the float. You know what I mean? They hold the money for 7 days, and they have such volume with the state of Oregon that they're making money on our interest, in essence, or something like that. So what we want to do is, if you get a list of those agencies who have expressed interest, kind of the kind of dollar figures we're talking about, so I can, in my head, kind of get my mind around what we're trying to do here.
Sure. And Mr. Chair, Senator George, we will certainly do that for you. I can tell you, though, that the scenario that you just described is certainly one that the Treasurer's Office would have great concern over and would likely require the agency to find an alternative to. While the PayPal scenario that we discussed and the limited exposure for something outside of a state fund is one scenario, we would be looking to make sure that the scenario you just described is typically not provided for.
Thank you very much.
Just one second. Did you want to address that?
Mr. Chair, if I might, I'm Darren Bond, Deputy State Treasurer. Regarding Senator George's question, that part of the process actually is governed by a different statute, set of statutes. In RS 293, the state agency, 293-265, I believe, state agencies are required to deposit their money with the state treasurer within 24 hours of receipt unless they can establish a business case for holding it for a longer period of time. And it's our intent that this change will only allow for, you know, for the transaction to happen. We have no interest in having PayPal or anybody else hold our money. So we will continue to require that the agency, through whatever agreements they set up with any vendors, continue to have those money swept into state treasury accounts absolutely as soon as possible.
Okay.
So just if that's any level of assurance.
Thank you. Senator Boquist.
Oh, don't disappear.
Yes, sir.
Follow-up to that, I just want to make sure I don't have any problem with the e-commerce. I understand that, and what we're really talking about is they have banks that they use and they have traditional mechanisms. They deposit in that. I'm sure they're FDIC approved. We have state banks we use now that aren't governed by DCBS and the banking, and so I'm not concerned about that. I'm not even concerned about collection because there's out-of-state collection. But as it was explained to me, what we're really talking about is we're selling or doing something, they're depositing the money into their third party's depositing into the account, and then the money is then being transferred to one of our state accounts. And there's no expenditure of state dollars going outbound. These are all incoming. They're holding accounts coming in. And I want to make sure that's one was explained to me, because like Senator Bonamici, I look at line 9, right-hand side, and it says, or transaction of other state agency business, and get really nervous. First two problems I got, I understand where you're going, but if you look at line 9, right-hand side, it says, or the transaction of other state agency business. And that seems to conflict with the idea that they're a depository, and we're getting e-commerce and the advantage of it. We're getting debt collection and the advantage of it and moving it to our state institutions or state regulated banks. But that looks like we're buying and selling and handing out blank checks.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I think our amendments will directly address that.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for getting that on the record. Any other questions? All right. Thank you for your testimony. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 14. We'll wait for the amendment and... Actually, let's reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 14. And I believe we have one other person who would like to testify.
He brought his blank checks with him.
I got lots of checks, so I must have lots of money.
No,
he didn't run around here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. Thank you for reopening the hearing. I'll be really brief. We also have some questions, so we would like to continue the dialogue with the treasurer. We started at 4:47 on last Friday afternoon, so and not a lot happens yet on the weekend yet. It's still early in the session, but we would like to. We have some issues. We do know right now that the state does use the FedWire system. It uses the National Automated Clearing House. It uses all the card networks, Visa, MasterCard, and Discover. And it's at least my understanding from our bankers that all of those are collateralized immediately upon the payment. So we are concerned with this potential non-collateralization of these payments, even if it's only for 24 or 48 hours. So appreciate your hearing this bill and letting us continue the dialogue with the Treasurer's Office.
All right. Questions for Mr. Martinez? Thank you.
Thank you.
Now I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 14 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 16. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 16, also from the State Treasurer's Office. This measure would allow the State Treasurer to assign a designee to serve on the Oregon 529 College Savings Board in the Treasurer's stead. It specifies that the State Treasurer is to designate a chairperson for that board. Currently, the Treasurer serves as the chair. That board, and then that chair would serve at the pleasure of the state treasurer. You have in your packets also underneath the staff measure summary a dash one amendment that was submitted by the treasurer's office. That amendment adds another related provision to the measure related to the Oregon 529 College Savings Board. It simply amends the statute that requires that board to publish a biennial report to the governor and legislative assembly. This would specify that report would be made on an annual basis rather than biennially, but that it could be made as included as part of the annual report by the treasurer to the governor and the legislative assembly. I should mention also the measure itself has no fiscal or revenue impact. The measure as amended by the dash ones would have a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Could we please bring up Michael Parker and Michael Salvaggio again?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Michael Parker, Executive Director of the Oregon 529 College Savings Network. And I will be brief, as this bill is relatively brief. What we're really trying to do with this bill is really streamline the College Savings Board. The State Treasurer and the State Treasurer will still manage the day-to-day operations and the day-to-day oversight of the state's 529 program. That is clear. But what Senate Bill 16 simply allows us to do is have the board have a little more flexibility in the case where the treasurer cannot make meetings or is out of pocket for an extended period of time, allows the state treasurer to appoint a designee to that board, and also allows the state treasurer to appoint another board member as a chair of that board. Currently, as the committee administrator had mentioned, the chair, treasurer serves as chair. He or she can continue to serve as chair, or the bill allows him or her to appoint a designee and serve as chair of that board in the case that he or she cannot be there. The second part of the bill really allows a streamlining of our reporting. Currently, the 529 network reports to the legislature and the governor on a biennial basis. And because the statute requires us to report in February, we often don't get annual numbers in time. And we thought it'd be better in the case to report to you annually and put in the treasurer's annual report in a way that allows us to be much more current and efficient with our reporting. So I believe the Treasurer's Annual Report comes out sometime the end of second or third quarter, if my memory serves, and so we'll be able to actually have more pertinent and current information in the annual report rather than reporting to you on a biennial basis.
Anything from you, Michael? Or?
Okay. Any questions?
Senator Boquist.
I'm just curious, since we're getting rid of one report, how much money are you going to save? Can we spend it someplace else? You don't have to answer.
We will spend it someplace else, Senator, two times.
All right. Any other questions for these witnesses? All right. I will close up the public hearing on Senate Bill 16 and open a work session on Senate Bill 16.
Mr. Chairman.
Should consider the amendment first, right?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I move dash one amendments to Senate Bill 16 dated February 8th, 2011.
Senator George moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 16 dated February 11th, 2011. Is there any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator George.
I move Senate Bill 16 as amended by the dash one amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves Senate Bill 16 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Tiffany, will you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici.
Aye.
Senator Boquist.
Aye.
Senator Monroe.
Aye.
Vice Chair George.
Aye.
Chair
Shue. Aye.
Measure passes. Senator Monroe, would you be willing to carry this?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much. Senator Monroe will be the carrier. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 16 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 109. Ms. Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 109 was pre-session filed by the Oregon Employment Department. This measure repeals statute that establishes the now obsolete interagency shared information system. There's a no fiscal or revenue impact on this measure. No amendments, Mr. Chair.
All right. Mr. Slater. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Shields and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Graham Slater, the Administrator of the Workforce and Economic Research Division for the Employment Department, and with me this afternoon is Susan Johnson, who is the Acting Administrator for our Unemployment Insurance Division, and Susan's actually here for Senate Bill 110 in a few minutes, but we're here together, and I will start with Senate Bill 109. So some of you know my staff and me pretty well for our work with the workforce-related economic indicators, unemployment rates and projections and wage information. And many of you have seen me present on a number of occasions at various legislative committees. We also operate a small program that tracks the performance of Oregon's workforce system. In other words, do those individuals find jobs? Do they stay employed? What kinds of wages do they get after they're served by this system? Today I'm actually not here to talk to you about the data or the trends, which is unusual for me, but I'm here in my administrative role today to seek your approval for this Senate Bill 109, which you've heard some other perhaps fairly simple bills today. I think ours may be the simplest. We're asking you to really repeal a statute that governs a data system that, with your earlier blessing, no longer exists. So in a nutshell, the history is that back in the early 1990s, Oregon was one of the first states to create this kind of workforce performance system. It was called the Shared Information System, or SIS. Came into being with Senate Bill 81 back in 1993. At the time, it was a very new thing to have information shared among agencies, and so the Shared Information System had very tight limitations on confidentiality and so on. And from the Department of Justice to our own agencies, we were all very cautious, kind of nervous about this new thing. But over the years, people became more comfortable. We have strict safeguards to protect the confidentiality and privacy. So then this new system called the Performance Reporting Information System, or PRISM, came into being. Senate Bill 400 in 2001 gave our department approval to start developing the new system. And by 2003, it was clear that PRISM was a success. It was much more flexible than the Shared Information System. So we started formally moving to that, and Senate Bill 250 back in 2003 made it clear that once PRISM was fully operational, no new data were to be added to the original Shared Information System. And in fact, in my own testimony at the time, a direct quote was that it started the process of shutting down the Shared Information System. So PRISM that now has taken its place as the workforce performance system for Oregon. We've had no new data added to this Shared Information System since 2004. We've had no information or analysis requests for the Shared Information System in several years. And in 2009, we actually destroyed the data because we really didn't want millions or hundreds of thousands of records sitting around, including Social Security numbers, for a system that no longer was functionally existing. So today, we're simply asking you to join with us, give your approval, if you would, to this destruction process, in a sense. Repealing ORS 657-732 completes the intentions that we shared with you and you approved through several recent years. And again, ORS 657-732 is obsolete at this point. So respecting your time, that concludes my comments. I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Does anyone else care to testify on this bill? Okay, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 109. Do we have any amendments on this?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Did you have
No, I just want to say, if we hear all the time about housekeeping measures, this is the epitome of a housekeeping measure.
And the elimination of a program.
And which is both of which are good things.
That's right.
And I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 109. Senator George?
Chair, I move Senate Bill 109 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator George has moved Senate Bill 109 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Tiffany, could you please call the roll?
Senator Bonamici?
Aye.
Careful, you'd be carrying it. Aye.
Vice Chair George?
Aye.
Aye. Measure passes. Senator George, could you carry this one?
All right.
Senator George will be the carrier. And moving right along, colleagues, I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 110. Could Susan Johnson come forward? There she is.
I know.
Welcome to the committee.
Okay, Chair Shields, committee members, for the record, my name is Susan Johnson. I'm the acting administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Program of the Employment Department, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you today and seek your approval for Senate Bill 110. It's approximately 4,500 employers in the state of Oregon utilize the services of employer agents. These employers literally employ thousands of workers. Current law requires the Employment Department to notify the employer directly rather than the agent in the event an unemployment insurance claim is filed. Senate Bill 110 modifies the department's notification requirements for employers and allows the Employment Department to notify the employer agent directly when a claim is filed or when an administrative decision is issued. Presently, when the employer uses an agent, the employment department is required to notify the employer in the event a claim is filed. That employer then has to fax or mail the notice of claim to an agent, who then again faxes or mails the notice to the employment department. So Senate Bill 110 eliminates that initial step of having to notify the employment department in the event a claim is filed. It benefits employers who use agents. It saves the employer the time of having to open up the mail and redirect that notice. It also benefits the agents. There are occasions when employers simply misplace a notice of claim filed and fail to meet a deadline. So this bill helps the employers to actually respond to notices timely. So that concludes my testimony. Happy to answer any questions.
Questions? So, Ms. Johnson, a typical agent in this would be a CPA firm for a small business?
Senator Shields, yes, it could be. Often there are employer reps, talks, ADP, that sort of.
Okay. Chairman. Yes, Senator George.
I have a bit of a conflict of interest in my line of questioning here, so I want to declare that going in. I have a case before the unemployment department that has somewhat haunted me, and I'm wondering if we could use this as a vehicle to possibly amend the state statutes. And the situation is that an employee of another employer made a claim against the employer, and during the review process, the agency assigned that employee to my company. And since my company was not a party to the claim throughout the entire process, I could never intervene. So there was nobody in the process that would represent my side. So this morning I had a tax hearing on this employee that didn't work for me on a case that I wasn't a party to. And so it's been a very, very complex mess. And in essence, what happened was is that the employee made a claim against their employer. When they were denied, they then said they worked for me. And so the employment department accepted that, which created kind of a nightmare for me. Seems like to me that if the agency is going to do that kind of sort of assigning an employee to an unrelated or a third party, there needs to be some way that if that happens, a person can intervene. I was wondering, since we have a unit here, kind of fix this problem, because this has led to hours and hours of my personal time, and then I've had to hire attorneys to deal with a claim for an employee that wasn't mine, we never paid, didn't work for me, didn't perform any service for me, and yet I got a tax claim against me for it. So I was wondering if the department would have any objection to using this as a way to allow employers who are found in that situation to intervene.
Senator Shields.
Let me clarify his request. Yes, it's whether or not the you would be open to amending the bill.
Correct.
Based on the delivery laws,
Chair Shields, Senator George, I am so new to this process that I really don't know how to respond, frankly. And I'm wondering...
But not to use profanity.
I really don't know how to respond. I'm looking to my colleague for...
Chair Shields, you're there.
Rebecca's here to back you. What do you say? Heck no?
Chair Shields, Senator George, for the record, and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rebecca Nance. I'm the legislative manager for the Employment Department. Through the chair, Senator George, we'd be happy to talk to you about this. I don't know if the relating to clause is going to get us there because it has to do with a third-party employer representatives. So we'd certainly be happy to talk to you about this and work with counsel, but in terms of a position at this point in time, we're not really prepared to do that. But we could have maybe offline discussion with you in your office and with counsel to see if maybe it fits, or whether it fits or not.
Yeah, I'm not sure it does or does not, because in essence what happened is that there was never any notification directly to me for this entire process going through. And so, as you, I mean, you know the case I'm discussing. The notice, I think it would fit in to the relating clause, just simply because allowing employers who are brought into employment claims through a claim that wasn't one of their employees probably would be able to be fit. But if we could discuss, it'd be great. It just happened to come up this morning because I was in before the employment tax unit having a hearing this morning on this issue. And it seemed like really frustrating to me that the process, once it kind of goes off the rails, there's almost no way to bring it back to some kind of sanity. And so
Well, through the chair, Senator George, we're happy to talk to you about that. Again, I am not personally well-versed in your case. I understood that you had one, but that was the extent of my knowledge because my knowledge is a mile wide and an inch deep sometimes.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to really fix my case because it's already gone through. I just think that it might be, since it's personal experience, it might be an opportunity to fix a problem for employers going forward, because I will tell you that once it goes off the rails, you are in a morass and you don't have a voice. And so it might be a real opportunity to fix that.
Sure.
And a loophole I saw.
And until we have something in front of us, I don't really feel comfortable commenting, but I would be willing to give this a delay for a week. It's still very early in the session, and we can consider this and then plan on bringing it back on Monday if you guys could put your heads together.
And again, Mr. Chair, I have no intention of making it retroactive. It's just that I see this problem, and if we can fix it for employers going forward, that'd be very helpful.
Okay. Senator Boquist and Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for clarification here, I'm trying to understand. I mean, paychecks would be another example that I used ADP who are agents. What I'm trying to figure out is it either or in this bill, and your intent is that when you send the notice out, it'll go to the employer, or it'll go to the employer's agent if they specify an agent, or is it still going to go to both of them?
Okay. Chair Shields, Senator Boquist. If the employer designates an agent, they will sign a document indicating that they want the notices to go directly to that agent. Therefore, it won't go to the employer.
Okay, thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Boquist.
There's some other housekeeping things in here, and I'm sure it must be just legislative counsel where the shalls and the musts and all that. LC does this all the time. As soon as they see something, the new lawyer changes something. I'm assuming that's housekeeping and there's not any intent where we're changing all the shalls and the musts in here with your department?
Chair Shields, Senator Boquist, yes, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you. And Mr. Chair, I kind of share the same frustration that Senator George does. I have businesses in my district who have experienced the same thing. It's for better with no fault of the employment department, because I like Graham's work, but it's just a case where the law says you'll do X, Y, Z, and, of course, you follow the law. And it doesn't leave recourse. And given the fact that we have 220,000 drawing unemployment benefits, and if you look at the U6 rate, the number is probably closer to 400,000, chronically unemployed in the state of Oregon. And so it affects a lot of employers right now. And given that, to keep ourselves solvent, we're doing a 38% increase. Employers, we want to do everything we can to keep employers staying in the state instead of closing down shop and leaving. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Ms. Johnson answered my question in responding to Senator Boquist, but just to clarify, you said that, Ms. Johnson, that you said that the department will notify the agents designated by the employers, and this is for initial claims and for administrative decisions. So the employer is not being notified anymore. So the employer is going to understand, I'm designating this agent, I'm not going to get these notices anymore. And if the employer wants to know what happens, they have to get the information from the agent now.
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici. Yes, that's correct. However, the employer and the agent have a very close relationship. So what happens is a claim is filed, that agent will contact the employer and get all the details regarding the work separation. That agent then notifies the employment department. They'll testify in hearings or with or without the employer. So the employers are well aware of what's happening.
Thank you. And just a brief follow-up comment. I understand that that's how it's supposed to work, but there's nothing that requires it to work that well. That sort of, you have faith in the relationship between the employer and the agent, I think, to make it work.
Chair Shields, Senator Bonamici. Yes, but that employer also pays that agent and can fire that agent. So I haven't heard, of too many issues of poor communication between those two.
All right. Senator
Obama, Mr. Chair, we have the same employee-employer relationship that got us into the deal. So, I would say accountants are probably not a good example, because it really needs to be somebody that understands the employee's hours, so on and so forth. Because I deal with these on a rather routine basis because of the transitory nature of military employees. Mm-hmm. And so they are a major pain in the posterior.
All right. Anyone else care to testify on this topic?
Or Senator George's amendment.
Yeah, exactly.
We will then close the public hearing on Senate Bill 110 and give you all until a week from today to see if we can get something on that other topic into this bill. All right, and then we have committee measures, right? Okay.
Mr. Chair, everybody keeps asking me about all these bills that you keep introducing. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm just voting yes on all of these.
All right. I will. Do I have to open anything for?
Just open a work session.
Okay. We'll open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee members. Measures.
Yes, Senator George. Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills with the normal disclaimer of that you don't necessarily support or oppose. LC 143, LC 1411, LC 3346, LC 3460.
Senator George moves that the preceding list of LCs be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just want to echo what Senator George says since I got nuked by a constituent last week. So, yeah, I'm game for discussing all these because this is the forum to discuss them. How we vote will come out later.
And that's correct. Particularly since one of these is your bill.
Yeah, I know. Exactly.
But I don't know who's one of the other ones. It's like, oh, yeah, wait a minute. It's a committee bill, folks. Don't be shooting the bearer of bad news here.
Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. That is all we have for today, colleagues. This meeting is adjourned.